You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks. Just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on the podcast today is Ray Mayring, CEO of QuarrusDog.
We were trying to be everything to everyone and just build this very generic product that could generate documents. Mm-hmm. But as we worked with more and more customers that came onto this, we started to see a pattern around a very specific set of documents that were challenging our customers. And those were proposal documents.
This is Ray. We dig into how a meeting with a bank CEO made him realize they were building backwards, trying to find problems for their solutions instead of solving specific problems. You'll hear how the ABZ customer framework gave him permission to say no, and why living inside Microsoft Office matters more than having the best features. It's about discipline of narrowing and what happens when you measure success by who you're willing to lose. Well, hi, Ray. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be here with you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I appreciate that opportunity as well for a number of reasons. We'll dig into that. It's been interesting to see what your journey has been over the last 13 years.
Yeah.
And I also picked up on the news of an acquisition that you recently did. So there's plenty of things to talk about today. Before we start, yeah, a little bit about you. What drives you? What do you get energy from as an entrepreneur?
I really have always enjoyed the kind of intersection of business and technology. Since I was young, that's been exciting for me. So it's been a driver to be able to work with our customers and kind of hear what problems they have and to figure out how we can solve those problems. That's been very exciting. This is also the second startup that I'm involved in. And it's just, you know, such an exciting journey to go on when you build a startup and you're creating something and, you know, you're building momentum behind that. And it's the build aspect as well, the creation aspect that really gets me excited.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like-minded people here, because that's exactly also what I like about it. Very good. So like a good bridge to the starting point. You said you're involved in two startups in 2012. It became the birth of the company, QuarrusDog. What was the problem that was screaming for a solution that you've been creating since then? What was missing? Yeah.
The problem that we originally identified was the challenge of creating documents. And to be quite honest, when we first started this, we didn't think about proposals as those documents. It was other kinds of documents. But we saw just how difficult it was for enterprise companies to be able to produce a document that was templatized back in the early kind of, 2010s, late 2000s. Yeah. That was a complex problem. And people were doing that manually. And at the time, we thought there must be a better way to get that right, you know, to do that. And we were experts in, you know, developing against the Microsoft Office platform, because the first startup that we had created was a consultancy. So that's where the idea came from is, hey, can we help companies to create documents? And when we started that, it was any document. We were doing contracts. We were doing electricity trade reports. And then we were doing proposals as well. And that's kind of how that thread expanded.
So in that journey, you know, because contracts, electricity, trade, journals and proposals, of course, there's a wide range of different things. What did you double down on at the end? You know, because at the end, if I look at it from a customer perspective, one will be maybe more valuable to solve as a problem than another one, because of the consequences getting it wrong, or the time involved that you waste.
Exactly. Well, I think when we started out, we were trying to be everything to everyone and just build this very generic product that could generate documents. But as we worked with more and more customers that came onto this, we started to see a pattern around a very specific set of documents that were challenging our customers. And those were proposal documents. And not just a quote type document, but a proposal document for a large organization. Like Vodafone in the UK was one of our very first customers. And they took us on this journey and said, we want to use this tool for proposals. Help us to really shape it in that direction. And then as we started to dig in and being transparent, we were challenged with selling a very generic tool because it could do so many things. Which market did we go after? So as we started digging into the proposal story and learning about the challenges that large companies had with proposals and RFPs, looking at how big the market was, looking at the competitors, it became very clear there's a specific need that we can address and we can really focus in on just that problem.
Yeah, exactly. Because a template is like, it's so universal. At the end, it's for the customer. Yeah, well, it gets the customer to think, I cannot live without this.
That's critical.
Yeah.
Absolutely
Because I
critical.
mean, when you just, I mean, you started talking about, we were about creating documents, and later on, we're creating templates. And like, okay, hasn't Word or Google Docs fixed that? Apparently not.
Well, back there was no Google Docs back in those days. It was really,
No.
really at the start of things. But the problem with Microsoft Word is that you could create a template. But what happens when you needed to do that at scale, right? Across thousands of people or hundreds of people. That's the issue with the document piece. And then that became very apparent with proposals.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true.
And a comment on your point there about being indispensable. For a company like a Vodafone of this world, building out proposals is so critical to them because it's a win or loss type document. You put a bad proposal out there that doesn't have the right branding, that doesn't represent the product in the right way, you can lose a deal over the quality of that document. So it's critical that they solve that problem and got it right.
Completely agree. And that, yeah, that's it is possibly the hardest part. And it's really about getting a good understanding about like what you need to prevent from happening. So yeah, to my question that I normally ask there is like, what did you do at that moment that from the start that appeared to be a fundamental decision for your success that you have today? Because I mean, technology was, of course, around. It was 2012, cloud was there. AI was maybe just coming up, but not really there yet. Yeah, how do you start building a solution that the large companies like Vodafone are saying, hey, you've solved the problem in a way that we couldn't imagine?
So on the technology front, what we looked at is, what kind of document did they need to create, and what were the components of that document that were important to them? The cover page, the table of contents. Yeah, those are normal things, but a product introduction, an executive summary, the pricing information. And then we looked at the technology that was really at its infancy back in 2012, and the ability to use XML back in those days to manipulate and change documents. And we started writing code that would change the XML behind a Microsoft Word document so that it represented itself in a particular way. What was interesting with Vodafone as well is that, when we met with them, and I'll never forget it because it was one of the most challenging meetings that I ever had, because actually my laptop broke on the way to the meeting and I couldn't demo anything to them. So I had to illustrate this all on a whiteboard. But when we spoke to them, they said, we really need this to operate within the Microsoft ecosystem because we store all of our content, like all of our, templated content, be it a product description or a geographic map. We store all of that in SharePoint. right? And we do not want to have to move that to another cloud platform. So you need to make sure that this is integrated. And we did that. We were small, we were nimble. And so kind of over December, January, we kind of recoded the whole back end on this thing to pull content and data out of SharePoint and run it through this document generation capability. And then we built tooling into Microsoft Word to make sure that it could be, you know, generated out as well. So the customer kind of led us on that journey as well to finding that niche and that differentiator for us, which is now scaled extensively for us in the business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can understand how that works. And it's becoming your mode, right? Because other people are, it's easy to kind of pick up on the low hanging fruit, but you actually went into the weeds. One thing I wanted to pick up on is, in the beginning you said we created a solution and everybody could use it, but still we decided to focus. And we just before our call we started to look into the 10 traits of my book, The Remarkable Effect. And one of the ones that you picked up on and said, hey, this is a really important one for us, is number one, acknowledge that you cannot please everybody. What was that moment where you realized for the company, yes, we have to focus and we have to start saying no? And what is, how did it go?
I remember that clearly because we were actually sitting, myself and my co-founder, we were sitting in the CIO's office at one of the banks in South Africa, having a conversation about this tool that we had built and how amazing the tool was. And we were trying to find places in the business where that CIO could use the tool. And it dawned on us that that's the wrong way around. We weren't approaching that in the right way at all. We needed to actually have the problem first.
Exactly.
Right? And be really clearly stated on that problem and that definition and come in through that angle versus, you know, trying to do all of these things. Because as we were having that conversation, this CIO was saying, well, can it do this? Can it do that? Can it do the next thing? Trying to fit it into places. And we realized that, well, for us to build all of that stuff, it would take us years. And we'd just be building and building and building. And ultimately, we needed to sell. So actually, coming out of that, we made the decision to remove certain features out of the product and deprecate those features and really focus on the problem that needed to be solved, which turned out to be proposals, and focus everything there.
Yeah, and then suddenly your main person to talk to becomes the sales organization.
Yes, exactly. We have a front door to come in on. Yeah.
Exactly. They have the budget. For them, it's a life or death, between air quotes, decision. And they will then get the CIO or the CTO to live with them.
Exactly, you know. But I'll say this, Tom, it's still a challenge. You know, we come from an engineering background, and our inclination is to build software. Right? When we hear a problem, we want to go build a solution to that problem.
Yep.
And so it's still a challenge of us, you know, looking at our product roadmaps and saying, what really needs to be in here? Because even within the narrow scope of who we now sell to and focus on, there is still this plethora of features and requests and opportunities that stand before us. And if we went after all of those things, we would be successful nowhere. We'd be trying to please everyone, right? And still today, we have to make sure that we have that discipline of what really needs to be in this product, which markets do we really need to focus on so that we can please that specific market, but not everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have any criteria for that to say yes or no? Does it have, but what are the important, the things that you, that makes you say hell yes or no?
Yeah. So we created this kind of scoring system for the markets that we work in. We just call it the A, B's and Z's, right? Yep. And we looked at where do we have low churn, high adoption, high usage? Where do we have users that are fanatical about Chorus Docs and absolutely love the product and almost would, you know, talk on our behalf? And we identified certain markets and we put them in this category of A. And what we said with the A category is, hey, we're going to partner with these customers or these markets. We're going to partner with them. We're going to integrate with them. We're going to specialize into these markets, and we will prioritize features that make that market very, very successful. Then we created a B category, which is kind of a secondary grouping of markets, and said, look, we're going to sell into these markets, but it's more reactive. It's not proactively kind of marketing and selling. We're not going to build features for that market, but the product can be used there, so we're not going to turn them away. And then the final area, we call these the Zs. It's basically, we just,
So not a
we're
C, but a Z.
Z, yeah, Z. Z. Americanized now, so it's a Z. But that Z is, hey, we won't work with these types of customers. They're not good customers for us, even if it's lucrative. We're actually going to pass them on to a competitor.
Let me make a small interruption here. Regis made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from typical SaaS thinking. He explained how they categorize certain prospects as Z customers, ones they won't pursue even if the deals look lucrative. Instead, they actively hand these opportunities to competitors. This isn't about being picky, it's about creating space to be exceptional for the customers who matter. And this is what remarkable software companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. They offer something valuable and desirable, and then they create fans, not just customers. Want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
We just won't do features that are specific to those markets. And that's been a guiding force for us in making decisions around the product, making decisions around marketing expense, sales expense. It's just who are our A's? Let's be exceptional in those areas.
Yeah, exactly. Reminds me of well, another trait in my book. You know, you create fans, not just customers. And I
Right.
like how you phrase that, fanatical about it, because that's what needs to happen. These people
Yeah.
talk about your product, talk about it to others, and there's no marketing machine that can actually live up to that.
Yeah, exactly. We had a user yesterday that I heard about, and he wrote a post internally, and it came to Chorus, and he said, if you try to take Chorus Docs away from us, you will have to pry it from my cold, dead hands, right? That's the kind of fanatical user that we want, that we need, because they love it. It's adding so much value into their day-to-day activity.
I completely see this in front of me. And I mean, funny enough, I hear so many companies complain about we don't have enough references, we don't have enough references. But at the end, all of these companies have that hidden in them once they start focusing on the ones that are becoming the fans.
Right.
Because the fact that you sell to everybody, you typically start selling to 80% that you shouldn't be selling to, and then you
Right.
ignore it, and you dilute the 20% that is actually becoming a fan. And the moment you
Yes.
turn it around, everything starts to become smoother and smoother. And suddenly, once you have a someone that needs to talk to a reference, you can just give them the whole list, just call anybody, and you get a good answer. It just makes
Absolutely.
so much difference. Talking about another, I think you said it's almost like a fundamental within the company. Trait number three in my book, aim to be different, not just better. How does that play out?
Yeah, that's a really important one. And I think I actually say those words very often to our product teams and our marketing teams. We need to be different, not just better. Because if you think about proposal companies out there, there are many, many proposal companies out in the market. How do we stand out? How are we unique in the things that we do? We don't want to be compared just on a function to function level. We need to be significantly different and better. And so for us, what we did that nobody else was doing was integration with Microsoft Office, integration into the kind of SharePoint backends of this world. And we brought the experience into the places people work, whether it be Office or SharePoint or Salesforce or one of those areas. Whereas everyone else in the market, they just built tooling straight into the browser. And that's the only place you can operate in the tool is in the browser. So, yes, are we better? In our opinion, in our key markets, we are better, but we're also different because everyone's in the browser and we're an add-in into Office. And we tell you, you can leave your content in your SharePoint environment. You don't have to move it into our browser-based cloud thing. We'll go get it where it is today. That's differentiated us significantly in the markets we're in.
Exactly, because for the others, of course, sometimes it makes sense because you got ownership of what you develop and how you can develop it, and you're not depending on others. But at the end, trying to get people out of Microsoft Office, tough call.
Tough call, right? Exactly. You're writing a proposal. Where do you want to be? Or you're building a pitch deck. You want to be in PowerPoint. You want to be in Word,
Exactly.
especially if you're an enterprise customer. That's
Yeah.
where you live.
Yeah, exactly. But then you also, of course, take on all the negatives that you get because now Microsoft is making changes and you have to be on top of that because otherwise things
Right.
break. Yeah, it's
Exactly.
there's always like the gives and takes, and these are fundamental decisions. So I mean, I would normally ask a question like what industry conventions did you break? And I think you just highlighted. It's a good one. Does it the difference? It's a different approach to solve a similar problem.
Right.
How is it helps you once you made that fundamental decision to do it different and to approach the problem in a different way? What has that done to your win rates, for example?
Yeah, it's the difference. It's the technology difference and the market selection that needs to go hand in hand. And our win rate has significantly increased in those key markets for us because the product is tailored to their needs. Right. So how we evolved after, the Vodafone story is we started moving into law firms and large engineering firms and anywhere really where we saw customers putting a CV or a biography and experience into a proposal. Like we narrowed that down even further from just proposals into those areas. And then we mapped the market. Now, if you just take someone putting a CV into a proposal document and how much time that takes to do that, if you're doing it manually, it's extensive. You're fighting with Word about, table layouts and is this the right picture and do we have the right CV? But we put all that tooling in there and we talk about that now and that we feature those things. And so our win rate has really increased in those particular markets where we track that win rate very closely.
And what has that whole thing done also to I call it the viability of the company. In my book, I'm talking about three levers: the value lever, the viability lever, the volume lever. The viability, of course, is one that is also about sustainability for the long term. I mean, you've been around now for 13 years, still around, going strong, really, just also acquired a company. All those type of decisions, how have they helps you to create a company that can stand on its own legs? Because I also realized that you've only got funding, I think, 2 years ago.
Took funding in 2019. Yeah, that was the
Okay,
first
okay.
time. Yeah, well, I mean, that was the first time we took US VC funding. We did have some funding out of South Africa, but
Okay.
for many years we've been bootstrapped as a business. We've gone through those phases there. Well, the lifeblood of a SaaS company is recurring revenues, right? And
Exactly.
to keep recurring revenues going, we have to keep delighting our customers so that they continue to, subscribe with us and stay on the platform. So that's really been important that we focus on what is important to those customers so that we can keep that revenue flowing in and we can keep growing. And we're very appreciative that we're in that position today of having many customers with multi-year contracts with us that allow us to be a viable ongoing business.
Exactly. I like how you say that, because a lot of companies are in there for the exit and it's about the revenue and the numbers and so on. You're in there for, well, you're, what I read between the lines is you measure your success by the impact you help your customers create, which is where the
Absolutely.
fanatical customers come back from. And that then, it comes back in ways that you cannot even forecast for. What have you learned from scaling the business from where you're in the early days and where you were in South Africa and now you're in the US? What have you learned from the scaling? What is one of the most important lessons that you learned from scaling? Let's put it that way.
Well, I think in the early days, We were very new and naive to a lot of the things that we were doing. I mean, we started a business in Cape Town, South Africa, that's now kind of a global organization. And one of the key lessons that we've learned over the years is that the success and the scalability of the business is directly proportionate to the quality of people that you bring on and their experience in this area and how they help you to scale. When we started with, a local South African talent pool, and they did an amazing job of helping us to kind of scale and kind of get offshore and into the UK and then into the USA. As we moved over to the US, we've had the opportunity to work with amazing people that have just brilliant process and plans and ideas of how to do this and how to scale. And they've brought that into the business to help us get that right. So I think that was, that was a key lesson. It's really about quality of people that you get to work with that help you to do that scaling. You can have a great product, you can have a great market, but you need the quality of people to help you get that scale right.
Interesting that you say that. So, can you give an example of just getting it right? What did people bring that solved a particular challenge in a way that suddenly becomes scalable?
Well, I'll just use our marketing team as an example. We have a phenomenal leader of our marketing team. She was actually one of our customers originally at Microsoft, and then joined us later, Jennifer Tomlinson. And what she's really helped us to do was to just focus and deepen that focus, but not just focus, be consistent with the things that we do in marketing, right? So it's very tempting to just A/B test everything and try everything and to be running after everything. But really, what we needed to do was to be more consistent. And then over a period of time, that consistency will pay off. Consistently market to the same markets, consistently come out with the right message. If you're switching all the time, you're not going to get the results. So let's look at this thing not in a 3 month time frame. Let's look at this thing in a multi-year time frame. And I think that's one of the great disciplines that she brought and helped me with was getting the focus right, but then being consistent, hitting those things over and over and over again, and then eventually it works. And we've already seen that in the way that we've scaled leads in the company and our brand and how it's been recognized.
I agree with that, but on the other hand also, devil's advocate, if certain things don't start to work the right way after 2 months or 3 months, people get impatient and
True.
they want to change things. And I've got these experiences of, okay, yeah, but we've been having this message now for 6 months or for 9 months, but you need to change it, because
Sure.
we get bored of it. Well.
Right. Right. And that's a point. I mean, we don't want to sit on things that aren't working, right? That's where the focus comes in. Like, what is working? And then let's be consistent with that. We know the right markets. We know we've got a customer base here. Let's make sure we're not switching markets all the time and trying to,
That's true.
chase shiny objects out there. Let's just be consistent and stay in the right space.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it's not only for marketing, it's everywhere in the business at the end. It's in sales, it's even in R&D. So, talking about like the metrics that you've 13 years down the road, there were certain metrics that you were likely using 5 years ago that you don't use anymore today because they simply don't, provide the value that you had before. Any example of that?
Of metrics that we don't use anymore.
Yeah, what's your KPI that was, something like you religiously followed when you were, for example, at 2, 3 million and has now disappeared?
Yeah, I think that I wouldn't say that there's metrics just off the top of my head that we've necessarily discarded, but I think what we've learned is to already drill those metrics into the right areas. Like I was mentioning earlier that we have the A, B's, and Z's customer base, instead of just tracking ARR growth across the whole group, we've narrowed that in to say, what's our growth and win rate like inside of a law firm, or in the legal market, rather? What's our net revenue retention there? What's our gross revenue retention? Those are key metrics that we look at and consider. We're probably less focused on just general clicks and adoption in the
Yeah, true.
product. And what we've narrowed that down on as well is, what are the absolutely critical features in the product that we know that are adding value to our customers? And instead of tracking, you know, how many times did the user sign in or, you know, adopt the product, really narrow in on how many documents are they creating? Are they tying that up to a CRM record to indicate win loss? Are they using artificial intelligence now extensively as part of that process to drive productivity? So from a product perspective, again, narrowing in those things to be less broad and really targeted at what matters, not just what can we measure, what really matters and is an indicator of success.
I like that because, yeah, it goes back to, okay, is the moat still the moat? And is there, are there changes there? Very often companies don't even know what really are the things that, yeah, combined together make a customer fanatical about the product or never want to leave. So, but these things, of course, also change. You're talking about the 13-year cycle, you know, the half cycle of the product for every product in the market is always shrinking. And it's thinking harder and faster today.
Yes, it is.
Talking about that, how do you go about that? Because you just mentioned also the role of AI. Living inside Microsoft Office, Microsoft Office, of course, also has plenty of AI. How do you make those distinctions? Okay, so what is the AI that matters to us in this ballgame?
It's back to markets and use case for us.
Yeah.
For example, you've got a tool like Microsoft Copilot. It's an incredibly powerful tool, very, very powerful. But it's a generic tool, right? I mean, it'll write a poem for you or give you a recipe if you want one. Whereas our AI is about proposals, right? It's about, should a law firm pitch on this opportunity, right? It's about, how do we structure this executive summary in the best way so that we're going to win more with that executive summary? Do we use any language in this document that is red flag language, you know, not approved language for the law firm, or even not recommended language for the law firm? Do we have a diverse pitch that we're doing in terms of the people that we're pitching in that? Those are very, very specific use cases.
Yeah, true. Exactly.
That we've, again, focused our product and engineering and marketing efforts and customer efforts on getting those use cases right, making them exceptional.
Exactly. It's, yeah, it comes down to the use case, and the use case is contextual to the to your ideal customer's profile and what they're going through. One thing that we talked about before, but since you also talked about your marketing manager coming in from Microsoft, which is what I understood, both the customer and the partner.
Yeah.
One question first around that. Your move from Cape Town, one end of the world, to the other end of the world, Seattle, which of course is close to Redmond.
Yes.
How important has that been for the the journey of the company to be close to that partner and customer?
That's been absolutely fundamental to the success of the business.
Why?
Well, firstly, proximity to just incredibly smart people that are sitting out here in this Redmond area, you know, being able to work across a table, and of course, COVID did make this a little bit more challenging in the middle, but across the table from someone that's building or planning on the Microsoft product and being able to work with them and hear their ideas and be part of that journey, that's key. Being close to our customers, which is now predominantly US, about 60% US, being close to the customers and being able to have conversations with them. Having people in the market that we target, like Jennifer, who's in this market, has worked at our customers before and understands how we go to market. That's critical.
Yeah.
And that is incredibly challenging from South Africa. It's a 24-hour flight to get to Seattle from Cape Town, South Africa. And there's only so much of that you can actually do physically to get it right. So being here and having this network around us and the people around us, That's massive. That's really big.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Ton, I only realized that actually in the move, right? In the move across, because we had a huge network in South Africa of people that we could call up and talk to. And when we arrived here in Seattle, we had a very small network to work from.
Yeah.
But the value of that network is immense because that's the way you get introduced. Those are the conversations that you have. Now, today we've built up a big, big network, bigger than the one that we had in South Africa. But the value of the network is something that I really learned through that move, is how critical that network is to us.
Yeah. And that's beyond customers, introduction to customers, but it's access to people. It's access
Exactly.
to the capital world. Yeah, exactly. I
Exactly.
completely agree with that. Yeah. I've been to Redmond a couple of times myself as a partner.
Oh, yes.
But we never decided to establish an office there.
Right.
Maybe it might have been beneficial, but at the end we didn't do it. Then like two questions more. One related to marketing and the fact that you said it's about consistency and it's about focus. One thing you mentioned prior to the call in terms of the traits that you live within the company is one that is important in sales, but possibly even more important in marketing, selling the idea, not the product. So you had a story around it, for what I understood. But yeah, my question at the end is, how does it play out in the company, and why is it bringing the success?
Yeah, well, the product is really a bunch of clicks and features and functions, and it keeps moving, right? The product changes and it moves and it adjusts. But the idea or the concept and the value of that product, what it brings to the customer, is so key. And it also, the idea incorporates not just software, it incorporates people and change that needs to be, made through that process as well. So if we're just going in trying to sell a widget, right, or a piece of software, that's a really, really challenging approach to take unless you have a very, very transactional type product that you just need to sell. But when you sell into an enterprise company, you have to be hitting on the pain point that you're about to solve. This is the pain. This is what that pain is, how it's impacting you. Here's the idea that sells you. And people buy stories, right? They invest in stories and ideas. They don't really care too much about whether your button is purple or green.
Exactly. Completely agree. Yeah, it's the story that hits the nerve. And it's the transformation that they're buying, not like the vehicle that gets them there. At the end, of course, they have to drive that vehicle, whatever that is. Well, as a closing question, of course, your whole entrepreneurial journey. What is a lesson that you learned at some point in time that has been, yeah, extremely valuable for you to understand? What is the advice that you would like to give other tech entrepreneurs?
I really think it's that point about, focus on things, acknowledging that we can't please everyone. I think we tried that. I think we chased a lot of stuff in the early days and tried to be everything to everyone. And it's really when we focused down on what was important and where we were winning and where it mattered most, that helped us shape everything else. It helped us define who we are. It was firstly that decision to be a proposal company. That was the first one. And then it was the second phase of that, which is let's target these markets, right? But that's informed every other decision that we made from there on. And I know the temptation as an entrepreneur is to, do a lot of stuff, especially if you come from an engineering background, especially with AI now, you can build a lot of stuff. But that stuff, it's going to be really, really challenging to actually scale and sell that stuff if it's not focused.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. Nice closing words for this call. Well, last question then, and more of a technical one. Where can people go to find out more about QuorusDoc or to say hi to you?
Welcome to hit me up on LinkedIn, Ray Mayring at Chorus Docs on LinkedIn, but our website, www.chorusdocs.com, and that's QORUSDocs.com. We drop the U after the Q just to keep it
Okay.
different.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Ray. I like the stories that you've shared, the wisdom that you shared. Good luck on the next part of the journey.
Thank you, Tom. Been great chatting to you. Really appreciate it.
And this wraps up my conversation with Ray Meiring, CEO of Quorus Dogs. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds, a quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Tong. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.